Blog Talk Radio.
All right, thanks for listening. This is The Unknown Show. I'm Bud Smith. A lot of guests today. Chuck Howe, Nick Everett, Robert Vaughn, Sam Snoke Brown. Talking about their project. What's going on? Thanks for listening in. It's another Tuesday, and I've got a bunch of guests on tonight. This is who's coming on. We got Chuck Howe. He's the author of I Had Wings, These Windmills Would Be Dead, out from Unknown Press. Then after that, we're going to have Nick Everett. She is the author of Self-Published Kindling and also Turtle, bookstore owner, model, editor at Cleftjaw Press. And then we're going to have on Robert Vaughn later. He's the author of Microtones, Dip Tricks, Triptychs, Lipsticks, and Dipshits. And he edits a JMWW. And then later, we're going to end with Sam Snoke Brown. He's the author of the book Box Cutter from Sunny Outside Press. Last week, we had Sunny Outside on talking about some different things that they got going on. And I'm looking forward to talking to Sam later. Looking forward to talking to all these guys. Christmas is coming, so, you know, a lot of boxes showing up here. I have no idea what's inside. It's all shit I ordered, but I don't know if you're like me. I order stuff randomly, and when people open it for Christmas, they, you know, it's pretty much a surprise for me as it is for them. Who knows? Last night, I wound up getting stuck at work until 3 a.m., 7 in the morning until 3 a.m., so that was fun. And today it snowed, so I don't know what the fuck's going on. I'm all backwards. I'm going to pull our first guest on, and maybe you can help me figure out what the hell's going on. First up, Chuck Howe, are you there?
I am here. Yeah, I'm wondering about myself. I can't dig myself out quick enough.
Yeah, you're getting some real snow there. I'm in this New York City. You're calling from Westchester about, half an hour north of here. And you guys get you guys get more snow than we usually do.
I don't know what it is about the city. It seems to melt down there a lot faster than up here.
It seems like every time we get a little rain here or something, you get like a 4 or 5 trees to fall down on your block up there.
Luckily, the last few storms have knocked down most of the trees in my yard, so I don't have a. I don't have too much more to worry about.
I like hanging out at your house because we can watch like car crashes on the parkway right outside your window. It's great.
There was one today. There was two on Saturday. Like literally right behind my house. I'm right on the Sawmill Parkway, and there's a bad turn right there. And anytime there's any winter weather, there's crashes right there.
I wish I had your luck, man. I don't get to see very many car crashes outside my windows because it's all just. Probably tonight, if I was to look out my window right now, I'm in my office. I'm looking out there. The sidewalk's kind of icy. I guess I can watch for a little while and see if anybody slips. That's my.
When I was down in Brooklyn, I was having fun doing that because you could just sit there and watch people slipping and sliding all day. I don't get the pedestrian accidents here. I get the car accidents. You get the pedestrian ones.
Yeah, it's like the prince and the pauper. You know, each one wants what the other one has. I just want to see cars explode, and you just want to see people get broken arms.
You know what? I hope everybody, even the ones that do crash for my entertainment, I hope they walk away okay.
You have such a good heart there, Chuck. I'm excited to talk to you about your new book. If I Had Wings, These Windmills Would Be Dead. It's a great collection of writing. and it follows pretty much the course. It's the course of your life from a little kid up until now, and you're in your. How old are you these days, Chuck? What's what are you weighing?
I am now in my 40s. I'm officially, I guess, middle aged. So you know, it's
maybe.
Yeah, it's definitely got the whole first half of it is childhood. Second half is, you know, young adulthood and crazy troublemaking. But, you know, at this point, I think most of my trouble, well, I can't say that. No, most of my troublemaking is not behind me, but, you know, I don't know.
No, I know for a fact that that there's definitely some more troublemaking ahead, you know.
I just try and be smarter about it these days.
Yeah, you know all the ways to get out of it. You, I know. I've watched a lot of like forensic TV, you know, so I kind of get a little glimpse of how the cops will track me down after my crimes, you know, and try to be a little.
Is it never leave a cigarette behind at the scene? They'll get your DNA from it. You know, have fun stuff.
Yeah.
Hey, he smokes this brand.
Yeah.
What's
that cigarette from Quentin Tarantino? Red Apple? The Red Apple cigarette?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. This fucker smokes Red Apples. This guy knows
so
what's
up. If you find Red Apple at the scene, you know it's Quentin Tarantino who did it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. definitely him. I was just reading an article about... the Coen brothers, how those two guys write they have like a little team, you know, obviously they're teamed up with the writing and the directing, and they don't really have, they kind of take turns with it, but when they write stuff, they just
sit
around.
I always kind of wondered how they did it, but they do it great.
Yeah, what they do is they have like regular office hours where they just go, and they're like, all right, well, you know, it's like 6 hours, they go to their office, and they just hang out and fucking take naps and whatever they do and just lounge around. They said the important thing is to just be in the office and just to, they feel like writing, and they feel like they have an idea they're going to fuck around with, then they're there, and they'll do it. And I think that's pretty relatable to art in general, you know? You got to like that Woody Allen quote, you know, you just got to be there. What is it, 80% of success is just showing up, that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. Somebody had just posted something that I thought was great that said something like, you know, I'm going to write one short story a week for the next year because I can't write 52 straight bad short stories.
I mean, that's
a very doable goal, and that's kind of the type of thing. You just have to do it, you know?
Yeah. I bring all this up because I definitely think that your collection of stories that just came out, it kind of, from the impression I get talking with you, it kind of grew out of a just like a goal, you know, like a goal of just like doing it, you know? Just like, how did the project start? If I had wings, these windmills would be dead start?
It really started on Facebook as just I'd get home from work at night and as an exercise almost, just kind of write a quick little memory. And then I started thinking to myself, you know, I should probably save these.
Yeah.
Things get lost on Facebook pretty easily. So I started doing that, and then I started editing them here. And so, you know, so...
Yeah.
And... by the time I decided to write a book, I had half of it written already, you know? There were things that you then have to go back and, you know, format and, oh, wow, I can't describe the same person 15 different times, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. That's the trick, right?
Yeah, and that was the real eye-opener with this whole project was... once you're finished writing it, how much still has to go into it, you know?
Yeah.
And quite honestly, I could keep editing and writing for another 10 years and probably not be done. But it's the point when you're like, okay, there it is.
Yeah, not enough of this, right?
Yeah.
I could probably go on and describe, you know, like what I think of the book and all this stuff. Would you read anything from it?
Yeah, sure. Would you like me to read? I know you got a bunch of people on. I'll just read one.
Yeah, read one. Anyone you like. We got time here, Chuck. You know, we're not rushing around.
I don't want to take away from everybody. You've always been nice enough to
have people.
Exactly. But I haven't read too much from later on in the book. So I decided today I'll read a story called The Naked Chick. You know, that's always fun.
Yep.
But each one of these stories, it's kind of following along my life. There's a whole section that's part of a band that I was in and this house that I lived in. And just to set this up, the house was basically heated by a wood-burning stove. And much like tonight up here, most of the time there was a couple inches of snow on the ground and we needed wood. And it'd be the middle of the night, so you'd go out and search for wood.
There you go.
Wherever you could find it. And that's where this story starts out. Here we go. The Naked Chick. Letty and I had been driving, looking for wood all night. It was cold as hell, with a couple inches of snow on the ground, but it was warmer in my truck than it was in the house. We had run out of wood again. There's some, Lenny pointed haphazardly, thrown together pile of logs. We could see construction vehicles down the wooded dirt road driveway. There were a lot of new construction going on, and they probably cleared the lot before the construction. We got out, threw as much of it as we could in the back of the Jeep, and then headed to the house. We quickly got the fire going again, but it took a while to warm up the place, so we decided to go back to the warm car and take the 10-minute drive to the diner in Stamford. Most of the drive was down dark, winding, sparsely populated roads. There were no other cars at that time of night, and suddenly, out of the corner of my eye, I thought I saw a naked girl in the bushes on the side of the road. Did you see that? I asked Lenny. See what? A naked chick. Dude, you're crazy. There was no naked chick. Lenny seemed pretty sure, but I turned the car around anyway. There's no naked chick on the side of the... He trailed off as we rounded a curve. And there, on the middle of the road, was a naked chick. Well, she wasn't completely naked. She was wearing a red silk nightie, but barefoot on the icy road. As I pulled over and started to roll down the window to ask her if she needed help, she ran over, opened up the back door, and got in without a word. We were pointing back towards the house, and I had just started driving. Hi. Can we bring you somewhere? She finally shouted as she jumped in between the front seats to hold her hands in front of the vents on the dashboard. Where were you guys going? We were going to the diner, but we're turned around now going back towards our place. Do you have heat at your place? Can we go there for a bit? I can go back home after he cools down a bit. She told us a long story about how she was a model. I had only glimpsed her before she got in the car, and it was too dark to see in the car, but she could very well have been. She was a former Marine. She had a husky that had been stolen, and she was tracking it down to a dogfighting ring in Connecticut somewhere. Her roommate had done a lot of drugs, thought she should sleep with him for cheaper rent, so she ran outside in the freezing cold, half naked. She had no idea how long she had been out there. When we got back, the whole house hadn't been heated yet, but the stove was fine. It was really hot. She ran right to the stove. Careful, that's hot. But before we could finish, she'd wrapped herself around the metal chimney of the pipe coming out from the top. We thought she would scream in pain, but instead she rubbed her silken, nightie-clad model body all over it as if she was doing a pole dance. I smell weed. Can I smoke weed? Sure, why not, we said. We smoked some weed with her. I have some coke. Do you guys want some coke? She was almost naked. Where did she have coke? Yet from somewhere, she had suddenly pulled out a folded-up piece of paper. Coke wasn't my thing, and I don't think Lenny had ever done it before. So we both declined, but told her to feel free. She broke up a couple lines on a CD cover and quickly snorted it all. As she looked up, she noticed Lenny's weight bench in the corner. She shot straight up. Lying on the bench, Unpanty Beaver pointed right at us and started bench pressing. When she stopped lifting, she came over to the table and talked for an hour straight. It sounded like more and more bullshit the more she went. The girl was batshit insane, and I thought it was more than just the drugs doing it to her. Finally, she noticed the exchange of, how the fuck do we get rid of her glances Lenny and I were giving each other? She mentioned that her roommate might be asleep by now. I grabbed my keys and we headed out. We dropped her off at her house, and it was at least a 15-minute walk from where we had picked her up. It was no wonder why she had pulled dance on the chimney. And that's the naked chick.
It's always great when like you have when you have something in real life that happens to you that's fucking wild, and you tell the story and it sounds so, not that your story in particular sounds like fake, but I mean, you know, you're almost kind of like, like the first time I heard you tell a story in person, I was like, and I know you and you don't lie, and it's such an awesome, really cool, weird thing that happened to a person, and it's awesome.
I mean, those are the things I love, the things you just can't make up. You know?
Yeah, you can't make it up. Like, if you made that up, it just sounds like, come on.
If I made it up, the two of us would have been banging her over the wood-burning stove.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing, yeah. Well, it's just a deeper thing about human regret, you know? You guys didn't get to bang the crazy girl on the wood-burning stove. Horrible.
Yeah. That's kind of an idea of some of the stories in the book. This book really runs the gamut because it starts from, I think I'm 3 years old in the first story.
the book starts out. I'd almost say it starts out on kind of a Calvin and Hobbes kind of tone. It's without Hobbes, you know. It's Calvin. It's Calvin fucking around.
The funny thing is,
as
a kid, I had stuffed animals all the time, and I didn't write about it, but I totally did have a stuffed animal that, like,
would you have,
it wasn't a tiger.
Well,
I had a deer.
What was your,
my favorite.
Yeah, a stuffed deer?
Yeah.
That's cool.
But it felt like a Calvin and Hobbes childhood. So.
Yeah. Last night at work, I was mentioning earlier, I got stuck at work until I punched out at 3 a.m., I think. And, I know. So I worked like 7 a.m. till 3 a.m. It was a really crazy long day. But in the middle of the night, I was just all, like, you know how you get when you work a lot of hours and it's just like things are getting kind of weird. It's like, I just want this night to be over. And I have the kind of job where I'm waiting for things and we're doing stuff and waiting for things to catch up with permits and stuff. They're all refining, repairing machinery. And I'm walking to the port-a-john and I see a fucking rabbit, like a wild hare, just sitting there in the stones in the middle of the oil refinery. And he's just sitting there. And I'm looking at him, I'm like, oh my God, is this thing even like real? You know what I mean? And so I try to get close to him and just, not that I was going to pick him up or anything or her or whatever. And I just kind of like slowly hopped away. And when I came back later, it was in the same area again, almost like it lived there. I was like,
that's great. Yeah. It's funny up here, we get them all the time, and I'm always driving home from work, and I think that they're suicidal because they just try to run in front of your car.
Oh, yeah. You definitely kind of like, you have this, like, really cool, my wife loves the area you live in, where it's, like, residential and all woods all around you, but you have, like, awesome little pockets of restaurants and bars and coffee shops and stuff.
Mount Kisco, New York. I got to say, the town itself is getting a lot nicer. You know, it does have a lot of cool spots. And I just always loved it. I'm close enough where I can be in the city in an hour, and I can hit a deer on the way home. So, you know, it's like
awesome.
The best of both worlds, kind of.
Oh, yeah. The American dream. American dream. Kill, you know, go out and appreciate all the culture and kill all the wildlife on the way home. Perfect.
Exactly.
So yeah, your book starts out in this really cool Calvin and Hobbes kind of note, and it travels through, and all of a sudden, you know, the teenage years, finding drugs, finding alcohol, you know, finding girls, and just going through all that, and you go away to college, and things are starting to change, and you're getting in bands for the first time, and it was just a really, really great collection of stories. I recommend it to anybody looking for a it's kind of strange to call your book is written like literary fiction, written really, you know, really good writing, really great writing, focusing on the characters. It has this other flip side to it where it's almost nonfiction, almost a memoir. But excellent book.
I kind of wanted to write it, you know, it is, I'd say, 90% nonfiction, but I wanted to write it in a very fiction way, you know, in a way where it could just be a story. You know,
yeah, exactly.
So,
What's
you know,
next?
I had a lot of fun writing it, and I hope people enjoy it. So.
Yeah. What's next for you? Are you working on anything? You got anything you're pursuing?
Well, it's funny, we're talking about the rabbits. I'm working on a bunch of short stories now about all the different little animals that live around here.
Nice.
We'll see if anything ever comes to that.
I know usually you try to catch a big chunk of your book. It seems to be about, like, following bands around, and it touches a lot on, like, fish. You're a big fish fan, big music fan in general.
Yeah.
And are you going to get – do you think you're going to get around to see any shows this upcoming season here?
Well, yeah, they've got four in New York City coming up for New Year's. I think I've hit the last few New Year's. I think this year we are not going to go, but they do a webcast, so I think we're going to – I'm going to sit at my girlfriend's house, nice and warm, and watch it on TV.
Yeah, that sounds good. And when you say your girlfriend, you're talking about Erin McParland. She did the book layout and design for...
She did my cover design. Just an absolutely unbelievably good job.
Yeah, she's a badass. Uno Kuno art director. Overall badass chick, Erin McParland. You can't go wrong with her, you know.
Yeah. And... I mean, she did the cover, but she also did, and this was another thing I had no idea before I started the project, is the formatting, the fonts, the, you know, everything like that.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky that I had her. She knows these things, and I was like, well, I don't know. She said, well, how about we try this? And I'd look at it and say, okay, yes, that's perfect. You know, just, she knew a lot of the stories. She had a good eye for it, so.
That works well. That's part of the fun of making a book is really getting involved and like the whole thing as a little work of art, you know, as start to finish writing it. It's nice to pass it off and have, you know, people edit it for you because you know you can never really edit your own shit 100%. But I tell you what, it's fun as fuck to get involved with putting the whole thing together, you know, as much as you can little by little. And yeah, man, what a learning experience.
Which
I do
have to give a shout out to one of my editors, was a guy named Bud Smith, who was really cool to work with.
Oh, yeah, when the guy's sober, he's all right, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I think he was drunk when he edited my book, but he did a good job of it.
Well, that's what you had other people involved to catch a shit I missed, you know? But,
yeah.
Fun, man.
That's one of the good things is... one of the things I really enjoyed is the people that I really like and care about were involved in it. You know, it wasn't handing it to somebody I'd never met before and said, here, edit this. You know?
Yeah, exactly. You know. You'll have to keep the date. Are you going to do any readings for the book? I heard a rumor there's something in February.
Well, I'm going to try and line something up here in Westchester
hopefully February or March. I gotta I gotta contact the locations first before I nail anything down.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been great talking to you, Chuck, and best of luck with your book. If I had wings, these windmills would be dead. And I hope to talk to you soon, okay?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me on.
All right, my pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
All right. I'm going to take a short break here. Chuck Howe. That's the Chuck Howe. How does he do it? I don't know. You can pick his book up on Amazon. And I believe he's also doing signed ones. If he's not doing signed ones, I don't know. Send him an email. Maybe he'll send you one anyway. Who knows? Life's a great big mystery. Well, next on the show, we're going to talk to Mick Everett. Mick is an American regionalist author, editor, and mother. She is a former Logic clinician, model, and bookstore owner. She writes novels, of which I've read one self-published Kindling, which was excellent, and she has another one called Turtle. She is currently editing at Cleftjaw Press. I just saw the news release about that today from Frankie Metro, up there on the old Facebook. Mick also does short stories, poetry, as well as nonfiction articles, and she devotes her free time to promotion of independent literature. She's also running an open mic event called Syntatics in Wichita, Kansas, which Kansas sounds good. Mick, you there?
Hello. Yes, hi.
How you doing, all right?
I'm doing all right, you? Not
I'm
too much right
good.
Now. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Yeah, well, you know, it's nice to talk to you, too. You seem like you got a lot of really cool stuff going on, and I'm happy that you could carve out some time to come on here and tell us about some stuff you have, because I read your book, Self-Published Kindling. I really liked it. I thought it was great.
Okay.
And I'm kind of excited to see what else you got going on. What's up with this open mic thing in Wichita? Tell me a little bit about that.
Awesome, yeah. Well, me and a couple of other folks in Wichita are putting together this thing called Syntactics, and it really started as a response to. I think all three of us are English major dropouts. I believe one of us might be a MFA dropout, but in response to the kind of elitist overtones of the MFA programs and how inaccessible they are to most young people, and it's kind of just a literary development group to give people feedback and, not really preach at people, but help everyone educate themselves and become better writers without having to, pay out the ass. So it's
I read a really, really interesting article today, which is kind of like the flip side of getting involved in doing readings like you're talking about. Do you know Nate Tower? Do you know him at all? He's a Nate Tower. Do you know that gentleman?
I think he's
an editor with like Arlby Snopes. It's a lit scene. And he had an article he wrote up that what the fuck is that? Submittable, the major, when you're submitting the magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
It's all about how editing for lit mags kind of helps a person become a much better writer, whether they realize it or not, just by reading a volume of submissions. And I think that's kind of like one out of three ways, you can either physically get involved in editing, you can physically get involved in readings and workshops, or you can try to go the college route and try to, as you kind of say, like a an elitist kind of program, an MFA program.
Yeah.
And
none of them have a guarantee, but one of them's a lot more expensive than the other two.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I guess it's like Goodwill Hunting, you know, that the kid, he was smart, you know, was a work of fiction, but smarter than everybody else just by reading books, right? That's the flip side of that. So you have this open mic thing going on. Have you had any events yet?
Not yet. We're still in kind of the development stage, but we're really excited to get it going. I believe our first one will be in January. I'm not sure on the date of that, but we're really excited to get it going here in Wichita.
That's great. I'm always curious about these great little scenes of lit scenes, music scenes in all different parts
mm-hmm.
of the country. And
mm-hmm.
how's the scene there? Have you been to other events that other people have thrown? Is it pretty cool, or what's going on?
I'm kind of new back in town. I was involved in the literary scene here in Wichita, about 2010. And then I left and was in Colorado for a while. And now I'm back, and things have changed. You know, there's a couple of really great open mic nights that are no longer. So we're going to try to kind of regroup some of the people that were involved with those. So I'm excited for that. But we've got a really great DIY scene here. A lot of people that are involved in indie music, indie fashion. There was a fantastic indie fashion publication here for a while. So there's a really strong DIY crowd who will kind of take just about anything that's thrown at them and make it into something great. So I'm looking forward to working with some of those people.
You see, that's cool to see, you know, the physical, you know, just getting involved with something, wrapping your free time around something rather than surrendering your free time to a worthless pursuit. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
What's your biggest output these days? What are you getting involved in? What kind of projects you have going on? Like I said, I've read some of your I've read one of your books so far, self-published Kindling, and I thought it was super strong. It was a really great book. And I'm looking forward to checking out some other ones. Are you working on any new material?
Yes, I'm I'm almost overloaded with book projects. I keep biting off more than I can chew with trying to write new books. But
yeah.
So I'll definitely have another book or two finished before too long. Also, self-published Kindling started out. You may remember the opening. It opened with... But people kept telling me to write a book, and I would tell them, no, I'm not going to write a book. I'm writing poetry. Poetry is a lot easier to write. And so at the time, before I started self-published Kindling, I was working on putting together enough poetry to publish maybe a chapbook or a book of poetry. And now that self-published Kindling, you know, that I've finished it, that I've completed the writing for it, I'm focusing a little more effort on trying to get together the poems that I had originally planned on publishing before I was even convinced to write self-published Kindling. I'm working on getting those poems together.
Yeah. For people who are listening and, you know, we keep saying self-published Kindling, what the book is about, I'll give a quick little overview. It's written as a kind of a memoir of a writer who is basically running an independent bookstore in Colorado, and while simultaneously raising kids and living in an RV in a Walmart parking lot. So it's a lot of things, you know. The book is a lot of things. It's a commentary on modern America. It's commentary on what the arts are right now, and it's also at times extremely funny and touching and insightful. It was a good, really good book. This book drew on some of your own actual events you've lived through, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I said the book actually it's touching on your own life. It's not a complete work of fiction, right?
Yeah, it's actually it's a memoir. It's safe to say that it's nonfiction.
There you go.
Yep.
It's so hard, you know, it's so hard sometimes when you read a book to really realize, you know, is this memoir? Is it fiction?
Yeah.
Is it nonfiction? You know what I mean? So it's like, it's one of those things, I think,
yeah.
especially since, who's that guy, A Million Pieces of Whatever, the Oprah book, remember?
Oh.
Who was,
yeah.
What was his name? I can look the fucking thing up. But it's like a million little pieces or something.
Yeah,
I know.
It's like a student memoir or something.
Yeah, where he went to rehab and all this stuff. I would be terrified. I would probably be terrified to write a memoir because I know, you misremember things. I know I would misremember things and stretch
yeah.
the truth a little bit. But it's pretty brave to actually to do that, to actually write about your own life and to approach it journalistically. So props to you on that.
Thank you. Thanks.
Would you talk a little bit about what was it like to run a bookstore, an independent bookstore in Colorado?
Oh man, it's a business it's a scary business to get into because there's not a lot of money in it. Markup on books
yeah.
is really, really low. You know, we're trying to keep authors profitable. We're trying to help them make some money. We're trying to have prices low enough that customers will buy the books, which doesn't leave hardly any money for the store.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I was putting in 60-hour weeks on top of working another job. So was my ex-husband. There
yeah.
are not a lot of, I mean, between the two of us, we were working about 250-hour weeks, all jobs included, and we were still
yeah.
homeless. You know, it was
yeah.
a very low-profit industry. And it was a lot of work, and I met a lot of amazing people. I learned more in 8 months at a bookstore than I did in 3 or 4 years of college. I learned more than in 1 month at a bookstore than I did in 3 or 4 years of college. Just I had to learn everything on my feet, and it was really awesome.
Wait,
it was a great experience.
Yeah, when you say with like learning about all the stuff you couldn't learn in college, it's more about, I guess, understanding the realities of what art really is when it's not mainstream profitable, right? When it's just, you know, it's like
yeah.
in the book particularly, you would even have events at your bookstore, and people would come
mm-hmm.
and they would read, and they would be lovers of words, but they wouldn't even
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't even buy a book. They would just come and
yeah. And some of that, I mean,
and, you know,
yeah, they say this is neat, this is awesome, what a great idea, it's fantastic, you people are doing this, it's fantastic, you're supporting authors and readers, but they wouldn't buy anything. And I don't blame that entirely on the customers, I blame it a lot on the economy, there's not a lot of money
yeah.
left over, most people have, for like spending on stuff. But on the other hand, there's a lot of people that were like, let's support the arts, let's support writers,
yeah.
and they thought that support meant like, you know, show up to stuff and like Facebook pages
oh, yeah.
and stuff. And that stuff is appreciated and it is needed, but, you know, you can't pay rent with Facebook likes. Authors can't pay rent. You know, they can't feed their families with people showing up to events. And if you know, it's great to do those things, but there's a lot of people that say they're supporting authors or supporting the arts, and they kind of fail to realize that includes being able to pay rent.
Yeah, you know, I've always been the type of person that never, you know, I don't expect anybody to really like dish money out too much because our artists usually work. You know, I was just reading
yeah.
something about my favorite singer Harry Nilsson. He had a job. He was being lauded by the Beatles. The Beatles were like saying Harry Nilsson was our favorite singer. Favorite records that they had, they'd go on the radio and say, Harry Nilsson's our favorite influence in America. And the guy still had a job at a bank, you know. He was still working at a bank for years after that. And, you know, Kurt Vonnegut, same thing. He was he worked
yeah.
at an electric company years and years and years. And but, you know, what we're talking about are two different things. Realistically, you have to – depending on what you want your life to be, you have certain things you try to set yourself up with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to get have a steady job with retirement and everything. But the idea of people coming to an event and
basically coming to an event, watching an event, not even really just contributing at all. It's kind of, it is strange when it's kind of hypocritical with, in particularly in the book where you talk about where the town you were in was kind of a little hoity-toity crowd, not really supporting the scene.
Definitely.
So that was interesting.
It certainly was.
Okay.
But I think I learned from it.
Yeah, you learned from it. That's funny. That's funny shit. So you guys at the time, you had this bookstore. You were doing okay with it, working a lot of hours. And can you kind of like kind of explain like what was going on with living out of an RV in a Walmart parking lot? Can you kind of like talk a little bit about that and explain what your situation was?
Yeah. You know, we got an eviction notice that we just didn't have a lot of, we got it over the weekend. We had less than 48 hours. We didn't know we were going to be evicted. So we still had the bookstore. And I think we spent the first night on the floor of the bookstore. We moved from campsite to motel to campsite to sleeping in the truck to campsite to motel for about 6 weeks, and that was really hard on all of us. But then our tax returns came in. our tax returns came 6 weeks late, and we decided to buy an RV. And actually, would you like me to read that excerpt from the book?
Yeah, why don't you, please?
Okay. I've got two short ones about the RV. I've got one that's while we're actually while we're in the parking lot. Let's see. "People just aren't meant to live like this," John said, staring at the ceiling. "They're just not." I looked around at our filthy motorhome with plastic bags taped around the holes in the ceiling, the wasp nest on the window, the useless sink and oven and refrigerator, lights that would never turn on, outlets that didn't work, the air conditioning unit and heater that were worthless without electricity. I thought of the filthy sink and toilet and shower in the bathroom and the water that didn't run. "People have lived without electricity or plumbing for thousands of years," I said. "We can survive without a fridge or shower." John turned on his side to look at me. "No," he said. "I meant the fluorescent lights." Somehow it hadn't occurred to me that it was as bright as day in the Walmart parking lot. While working on the truck, it had been a benefit, but John was right. People weren't meant to live under constant light. That gave me something to think about, so I lay in John's arms and listened to the chatter of confused birds, their circadian rhythms totally fucked. And then, I have one other about us actually purchasing the motorhome. It's a bit funny how we came to live in a motorhome in the first place. It's not funny at all, but it's a story I can tell like a joke. What do you do with $4,000 from your newly arrived tax return and an eviction notice on your credit history? You stay fucking homeless because no one will rent to you no matter how much money you hand them. Haha, okay, here's another one. Four people drive to Fort Lupton to buy an RV for $800. 2 miles out of Fort Lupton, the RV dies at the top of the hill. The family goes back to the RV's owner, and they say, "Hey, you sold us a shitty RV. We want our money back." The previous owners take a look at the RV, and the engine's choked. A valve needs replaced. The family gets their money back and drives back to Longmont. 2 days later, they drive to Brighton to pick up a different RV for $1,000. They make it 5 miles out of town when the RV dies. Again, at the top of a hill. The family goes back to the dealer and says, "Hey, you sold us a shitty RV. We want our money back." The dealer says, "No dice. You bought it. You're stuck with it. The engine, radiator, and batteries are all toast. The RV needs to be completely rewired. It will cost hundreds of dollars." And here's the punchline. A valve costs about $50. I don't like stories like that. I don't memorize stories by their punchlines. I write poetry because that's what I can write while I'm on the side of the highway trying to string together words while semi-trailers zip by and the gust of hot wind takes up my skirts and prairie dogs bark at me and the kids fight in the cab of the truck and John leans down under the hood of a Dodge Sportsman while steam billows and hot oil burns his fingers and splatters my calves. I'm stringing words together in my head while John and I fight over whether we will sleep in the slanted motorhome, resting at a tilt because it's parked halfway off the side of the highway and half on the steep ditch, shaking every time a car passes, or whether we will pay $60 for a motel in Brighton, or whether we will sleep in the truck in a parking lot, or whether we will leave the RV behind and drive back to Longmont to sleep in the bookstore, or whether we will pay $150 for a tow. I'm lying awake in bed in the motel room, writing poetry, writing my masterpieces in my head, instead of wondering whether John is slashing tires at the car lot where we bought our RV, or finishing off a bottle of whiskey under a bridge, or when he's coming back, or if he's coming back at all. I've checked out of the situation completely, though my entire body's weight is on the brake pedal, my fingers clenched and white on the steering wheel, my thigh is ignoring the sting of a yellow jacket, my body steers the RV, trailing behind 5 feet of tow chains in the back of John's truck, terrified of his rear bumper. My mind is not there. It is busy thinking of nouns and verbs and stories I can use instead of adjectives like lonely and desperate. So that's how we bought the RV.
Yeah, that's how you got the RV. That's great. It's been really great talking to you about your books and your writing and stuff. Owning a bookstore, this doing these readings, doing all that stuff. I just saw the announcement today. You're starting to edit with Clefjaw, and they have the coolest shit going on. It's a great
lit
mag.
I'm so excited to work with them.
Dustin and Frankie always do a fantastic job with all the stuff that they do. And congratulations on that spot. And I hope
thank you very much.
I hope you gain a lot of insight out of that because it's.
I'm sure it's, I will. Cool. I'm sure it'll be fantastic. Thank you.
So I want to thank you for coming on the show. It's been really cool talking to you. We'll have to do it again real time soon, you know.
All right. Thank you very much. I'd love that.
All right. That was Mick Everett. And she's got a lot of stuff going on. Holy fuck. Makes me feel easy. Next on the show, I'm going to talk to Robert Vaughn, who is he's a pretty big badass, this guy. He is editor at JMWW/Fiction. He leads roundtable workshops in his hometown there. So he's a very knowledgeable fellow, and he's got a great book called Microtone that's out from Servina Barba Press. He has another one. It's got a great title, but a mushmouth like me definitely will fuck it up. I'm gonna try it again. Diptychs, triptychs, lipsticks, and dipshits. And that was definitely designed for a dumbass from Jersey like me to fuck up on the air here. And I'm currently waiting for Robert's got a full-length collection of, I believe it's Flash and Poems called Basements and Attics coming out really soon from Civil Coping Mechanisms. So I'd like to welcome Robert Vaughn on the show. How you doing, Robert? What's going on?
Hey, bud. How are you, man?
I'm doing pretty good, you know. I'm trying to get back into my regular rhythm here. Things have been fucked up for quite a little while with work and holidays
have
and all
they?
That. Oh, my God. I've been working like a dog, man, ever since before Halloween. It's been pretty brutal, you know.
Yeah, last time we talked, you were working some dip-ass shift, like 5 to 3 in the morning or some crap.
Yeah, I was. I was working. They had me night shift for a little while there, just... You know, basically just repairing parts of the oil refinery, the plant I work at, and my God. But, you know, I've been reading a lot. I have time to read at work, which is always good, you know. I've been enjoying your new books. I want to congratulate you, man. I want to congratulate you on this new one that just popped up just yesterday. You want to talk a little bit about diptychs? Would you like to?
Yeah, and by the way, you know, you shouldn't berate yourself because the guy from New Jersey pronounced it accurately.
I got it right. Holy shit!
Yeah, you got it right. Yeah, a friend of mine from high school, when I posted the link, you know, on Facebook, a friend from high school said, "Okay, say that 10 times as fast as you possibly can, but you have to be drunk, and then you really fuck it up. It's kind of fun that way."
Anybody can name a book like, you know, Diamond Mouth or like, or, you know, whatever, crystal vase. You know, you got to be a real fucking brave person to name something as complicated as that. Bravo to you. Right on, you know?
Thanks. Well, you know, the whole idea for this chap came about, I think it was almost, you know, it was simmering around the same time as Microtones, which, you know, I just love that, you know, you always feel great about that first thing you put into the world, you know? And,
yeah.
You know, that I was a virgin until that birth in March. So I've always been a real lover of playing with form and poems and stories that come with an ABC or a 1-2-3, you know, like little Jackson 5 vignette. But, you know, I just love that shit when you throw it on a page and something pops in your head where you go, hey, why don't I number this one? And and I don't ever really do that intentionally. It's just sort of like how it comes out. And it's like every, you know, it started out being really like every 10th or maybe 12th or 15th thing I would write. And then it became much more frequent because, you know, I do a lot of short bits. So I started to just, you know, I would get them published, but I started to just realize, okay, I've got a tendency here. It was pointed out by people both that read my work and then also just, you know, I started to kind of stash them in one place.
Uh-huh.
And that's how the concept came about for diptychs and triptychs, you know, because really it diptychs, for those people that don't know, diptychs is of two, you know, something that's told A, B, or two forms or two chunks, two paragraphs. And then the triptychs would be the A, B, C, or the 1-2-3, you know, it'd be something that's a three-way thing.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, I started to play with the titles, and then I just thought, well, a lot of my content has stuff with either, you know, like really out there kind of frustrated housewives or hookers or, you know, the lipsticks came in there with, like, you know, whatever, blowjobs, whatever. And then the dipshits, I just thought, well, the guys always end up being kind of airheaded and stupid in my work, you know, like they're just fucking douchebags.
Yeah.
So I thought I would add the dipshits in, you know. So far people really like the name. Like that, I was just in Chicago last night for a reading, you and my buddy Meg Tewitt and David Tomaloff were the featured readers, and I got lots of good feedback about the book, and they kicked it. You know, they were just great, both of them. They're so funny. I was laughing my ass off when I hang out. Every time I hang out with Meg, I just feel like I'm in grade school. You know, we just laugh our asses off.
Oh my God, she's fucking hilarious, man. She's smart as a whip too. You know, I guess,
blizzard.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, they drove, I mean, it was so shitty. They drove down from Racine, you know, and it was a blizzard. Great, so.
Yeah. So this book, it just popped up, and you have another one coming out, like, right around the corner, Basements and Attics.
It's actually the opposite. It's the flip of that. It's actually attics and basements. It's the A and B. I always think of it as A and B because when I started to shop this project around, I had it in two separate things where I just had it like A, and like I was thinking more like a music thing, like side A, side B.
Oh, cool.
And then it kind of eventually morphed into first it was attics, literal attics, like of a house, attics and basements. And now it's addicts, like addictive, addicts in basements, you know?
Yeah.
So it kind of morphed over time. And then, I've been working, you know, I got to say, I've been really, really fortunate. I know I just heard what you were talking about with your last guest, and I'm totally into the DIY scene. And if that's your right groove, you know, and you really feel like that's the way you want to go and you want to be able to score and help other people make the money from their projects, hey, I don't say that's a bad way, but I really feel also just representing the indie presses, I feel like I've been really, really lucky because this, you know, Michael Seidlinger is the guy that's bringing out Attics and Basements.
I can't say
enough about this dude. He is the coolest editor. He is so rocking. All the different things that we discuss, concept, the look, the way that the pieces fit together, you know, the selection of what should come first in each section, it's in three different sections, because actually in Attics and Basements, the ampersand, the and part is going to have its own section. So, yeah, you know, I mean, he's been really, really great. And I love the timing of that because there's a couple of months through the holidays for me to promote the diptychs and triptychs or just do some, you know, events around that. And then AWP, I'll have Attics and Basements. That was our goal, to be able to have it, you know, in hand at in Seattle at the end of February. So
that's great.
Cool.
Yeah, you know,
it's really cool. It's always so cool to have a, you have a project. It starts as a little seed. It's like this tiny little thing, you know, and then it like it, you know, it builds up organically, and before you know, you get a project, and just you know, seeing it on the horizon, it's a good feeling, right? You know, it's exciting.
It always takes you know a year or more. Because by the time that you have something completed and you're ready to shop it around, you know, it usually takes, if someone picks it up, it takes 9 to 12 months for them to fit it into their schedule, you know, wherever they're at. That's the other thing that's different with DIY. You can finish a book, pop it into the system. You still have to do all the upload and page numbering and, you know, all that. It does. It's a fucking hassle. I did it with one book of mine. Yeah, Flash Fiction Fridays. Yeah. And I'm not cut out for that. I'm really not. I hats off to people like your last guest who say, "Yep, this is what I want to do, and I did it, and I promote, you know, I do it all." And I'm like, "Holy shit, you really can do it all." Because I love, my biggest passion is just putting pen to page. I love the writing part of it, you know. But I am really envious of somebody who can do all the layout and the planning and the structure of it through Create Space or Lulu's or wherever you're going to create these fucking beautiful pieces that you're birthing, you know, and I'm not built that way to do that type of it, you know, like I'm more like, find me, you know, point me in the direction of someone who likes my work. You know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think it's like with writing, it's like a lot of things with other kinds of business, you know. As soon as you're out at these events or, like, you're talking about EWP, all of a sudden you're surrounded by all these different publishers, all these different people at different readings, and you just your work kind of finds its way, you know. You kind of find that person who's like, I want to put something out by you, or you know, just you have a few drinks, and all of a sudden you have a project you're working on, and that's what excites me about writing. It's the teaming up with editors and working on a project, you know, it's like you can have a thousand pages of something that will never get seen sitting on a shelf, but man, it's ever exciting to put out a, almost like an album, you know, get together, put it out.
I love that whole thing that, I totally agree. And I think we've talked about this before too, not on the show, but that whole idea of collaborating, you know, just having it come together. You know, with an editor or with a team, like you put out that kick-ass Uno Kudo, you know, I mean, that sometimes that group energy that you have behind something really makes it all the more, you know, it has that resonant feeling about it and has that energy that lifts it out into the world. You know, people can feel it when they're reading from the page, you know, and that's the other thing for me is, like, in terms of self-publishing, I've got to have editor's eyes on my work. I make a lot of mistakes. I fuck up a lot of spellings. I'm just not clean. You know, when I write, I just let it come out how it does. And so it's really helpful for me. This is one of the experiences I had with Microtones is one of my friends in Boston at the AWP there, you know, we launched it. Gloria had it for the AWP last year. And I remember we read it. We had it at the first reading. I was given the amount of copies from her. I think it was 20. Very, very generous, by the way, for a publisher to give you that many as a gift because you're joining their team, you know. And they just went like hotcakes. This reading was from 1 to 5 in the afternoon. Uh-huh. They flew out of my hands, literally. And so then I'm in my hotel room that night, and I'm laying there, and I'm trying to fall asleep. You're so excited. You know, you wait, just fucking wait till AWP. You're going to flip out. And so I'm laying there, and I get a phone call, and it turns out to be Chris. And he's like, "Hey, you know, I hope I didn't wake you up." Nope, what's going on? Hey, I want to talk to you about Microtones. I'm like, okay, shoot. You know, and he basically kind of went through these things with me where he said, there's a half a dozen, maybe more, you know, some errors in here. I didn't even see them. You know, I had him go through page, you know, on page 4, there's this. On page 7, there's that. So the kind of cool thing in a way is there's these renegade copies out there because we did end up changing the manuscript. I asked Gloria if it was okay after the conference.
Sure.
But, you know, there's these ones that I sold right off the bat where it's like they're out there, you know. But I'm just saying, I say that as an example, like in classes and stuff, because I feel like we always think it's 100% accurate, you know?
Never.
It's like a first draft when it comes out of you and you're like, oh, that was the coolest friggin' thing I wrote this morning. That was great, you know?
Yeah,
you read it aloud in a group and people are like, well, what about the tense changes? What about the, you know, tone that drops off in the middle of that conversation? What about the, you know, all of a sudden you're like, oh, maybe it does need a little work, you know, like.
Yeah, sure. I'm really into, you know, when there's a reason there's second editions and third editions, and then all of a sudden maybe a title lives on and another publishing house puts it out, and then they put out their first edition of it, and it's edited further from there. And the classic books that we read now that live on, you know, who knows what, you know, how many rounds of edits they've gone through, you know, how many times was Catcher in the Rye, you know, edited, how many times was To Kill a Mockingbird edited by all these different people. And just every time you do a sweep, you find a little something, man. That's what that's all about.
Absolutely. So what are you working on right now?
Well, I'm just about right. I'm on the verge of rewriting a book called F-250, which is it's like a, you know, fictionalized. It's like that stereotypical white boy thing. You know, you write about your own life, chasing girls around and stuff when I was younger and a little more drunk in bands and shit. I was just reading.
The Ford F-250 book?
Yeah, the Ford F-250 book. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, because, you know, we talked about that the first time I came on your show, because remember, I had a Ford F-250, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm doing that. I definitely want to. And then you have a short story collection that you're wrapping up, right?
Yeah, there's a short story collection that's it's up in the air. You know, what kind of home it's going to find, but that's been wrapped up for a little bit. And I'm working on it's like two novellas that are connected, and it's like a game of telephone, you know. It's the same story told twice from the boy's point of view and then from the girl's point of view, and first person, and kind of going through sequences of events that starts off with they're trying to have a baby. They're teenagers are trying to have a baby together. An abortion gets forced, and then bad things happen. The kid kills the girl's parents, and they go on the run together. It's that old cliche American Bonnie and Clyde Badlands story.
Love it.
I think I'm hoping it's dissected a little deeper than you know, the cliche. That's the point. We'll see what happens, you know.
Well, you just got to pick those places where you want it to spin out into these weird, you know, other random diverting things that spin out. So it doesn't have that, you know, cliche pat feel, but you're creative.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you've got a ton of stuff in, you know, in most of all your books, Tollbooth or something like that. You've always got these places that like take me on this, you know, acid trip. So that's wonderful.
Yeah, definitely. It's really cool. You were talking about, you have this round table thing you're doing and talking to people, giving each other criticism and offering critiques. And I think that's pretty cool. How long have you been involved with doing that?
Well, I've been a round table person in other scenarios before I actually moved. I've lived here in Milwaukee for 10 years. So about these groups that I've been running here, about 8 years, there was an existing school when I came here. One of my mentors, Judy Bridges, who wrote a really great a book called Shut Up and Write, which is kind of – she still teaches this course here. And it's kind of for writers of all different levels, but really, really great instructional stuff about the aspects of story and how to tighten things, you know, get better and create a daily practice and set goals and all that kind of stuff. And then she had she ran the writing roundtables at the time, and I actually went through the course just as a refresher kind of thing when I moved here. And then I approached her very soon after I got into one of her roundtables and said, hey, have you ever thought about adding someone else that runs the same system that you do, doesn't divert, you know, becomes like sort of a junior Judy Junior sort of thing, you know?
Sure.
And she said, let me think about it, and she did for a couple months, and she brought me on. And now she has since sold the business. I have a new boss for about the past 3 or 4 years, Kim Sewer. She's excellent. But, I run two different groups. One meets every other Friday morning for 2.5 hours, And then the other group meets once a month on Thursday night. So that gets a lot more people that, you know, work days. And a lot of teachers in that group for some reason, teachers that want to write. So so that's
incredible.
Cool. But, yeah, it's a really nice system. You know, I had this really incredible experience recently where I got to know online, I got to know Lydia Yuknovich a little bit. And she's in that incredible roundtable group with, you know, with Chuck Palahniuk, who wrote Fight Club, you know, and Choke, and all those great books, and Cheryl Strayed, who recently wrote Wild, you know, and that one, nuts. That book, like, just blew up in terms of popularity. Well, someone had asked her in an interview, had asked Lydia, you know, what do they do in the roundtable, in this, you know, amazing roundtable with all these writers all of a sudden getting so popular, and they follow the exact same protocol that we do. I mean, it's literally, you know, before I knew her and before we knew of each other's groups, it's literally the same structure, and and I think that's what makes people successful, really, is following this tight-knit way that we give feedback, how we devote, you know, X amount of time to the people that are in the group.
Uh-huh.
To me, you learn as much about craft listening to someone else give feedback on someone else's pieces as you do on your own. And,
there you go,
you know, and that's really that's really it, discussing the writing from 10 or 12 different perspectives on whatever genre is in front of you, and then also hearing someone orally read their own work, because that becomes something that can also have impact on how you write too, you know, because it's an oral tradition, really, storytelling. So can I read a piece or two? Do we have time for me to read a short piece?
Oh, my
piece
God. Yeah, of course. I was actually just going to go in that direction. I would really love it, not to give you direction here, but I want to hear some stuff from your just released chapbook if you're in the mood.
Yeah, I was gonna if it's cool, I was gonna read like one or two shorties from Diptychs and Triptychs, which is the new one.
Yep.
And then maybe just one piece from Attics and Basements, because that's out in February. Like just one that I've been reading a lot lately, and it's a fun kind of, you know, fun kind of piece, strange piece.
Yeah. Yes. Read these, and then I want to talk about them a little bit, and. Yeah.
Okay.
I want to hear more.
Okay, so I'll read a triptych first, which is in three sections, and then I'll try to pick a diptych. You know, I'll go backwards from the title, but so the first one is in three sections, and it's called Going to Reseda on the 405. Under Justin Bieber haircuts, they giggle like the Bachelorette, bouncing, swaying to Bananarama, covering their mouths with hands that were unable to keep him away. At the arcade, they watch videos of cops chasing criminals with weapons while playing video games competing to crush their opponent, then maneuver the 405, six lanes, blitzed, KROQ blasting back to Reseda. We are all going to Reseda, model, cop, Tabitha, Justin, in some way or another, going to Reseda someday to die. And the radio man laughs because he fucks a model with beaver hair too. That's that one.
Yeah. That's fucking crazy. What's the read that line again about going to die. Can you repeat that line?
Yeah, let's see. Okay, so we are all going to Reseda. Model, cop, Tabitha, Justin, in some way or another, going to Reseda someday to die.
Badass. I think I heard you read this at a KGB bar. I don't know if I'm...
I might have read it. Yeah, this piece has been floating around there. It was actually published at Ellie Mae, which no longer is around. But I think Brandon Hobson took it a couple years ago. And, it's one of those pieces I could not get. I couldn't get it into Pank. I couldn't get it. It just would not get an acceptance. And I don't know. Brandon's just a great guy. He really is turned on by my, like, weirdo, wacko shit, which I just love. I love editors that will take risky shit like this and throw it up there. So so that was, you know, that was fun. But, yeah, I think I did read it in Chicago.
Nice.
Was that it or in Boston? Oh, no. Actually, I'm sorry. In New York.
Okay. Next.
Okay, next. All right. Do we have time? Do we have time? Are you cool, or is it?
No, you got it. You got all the time in the world, man. Fucking, read a few
right,
more,
man.
please.
Okay. I'm trying to find one that's in two sections here, so we'll have a diptych. Okay, here's Reckless.
Mm-hmm.
Reckless Abandon. Reckless. He shows a Reckless. He shows a reeking disregard for the safety of others. He has, of late, he knows not how, lost his mirth. Wild and foolhardy, he bungee jumps from sharp objects, dallying, drives three sheets to the wind, drinks kamikaze shots while bowling for dollars he doesn't have. To be or not to be, he is reckless, like a necklace strung too tight without a clasp, a wasp with no asp. Abandon. She ditches the car on a back road in an attempt to flee her past. She puts her hand over her mouth. The robin egg crushes underfoot. She can taste danger seeping through her pores, down her back, into the willow roots. Incapable of her own distress, she will fling herself, unrestrained, to the swamp, rue from the brook. She springs free from encroachment, skimming like an amoeba across quicksand.
I gotta say, man, you have this great tone you usually hit, which is like the Twin Peaks tone, you know. I can almost hear those, the Twin Peaks guitars in the background. Pretty great.
Do you know what's funny that you say that is on this new book, the blurb that Kathy Fish gave me on the back, she refers to David Lynch.
Really?
Who, you know, David Lynch, Twin Peaks. Yes, she says. She says, Robert Vaughn gifts his readers with a fiction that reads like the best possible mashup of David Lynch and Wes Anderson.
Oh, nice.
So it's so funny that you picked up on the whole Twin Peaks thing, because I think that show really did have a profound influence on me. I do. I know people kind of – a lot of people are real haters of his work, but I'm not. I love – I think he's a real visionary in a sense, and I think there's something about his style that carried over into me. So
– I would
Here's
say
another
that,
diptych.
Hold on a second. I would say that your writing has a very cinematic quality to it, man. So, you know, I can see why Kathy Fish would reference two directors when talking about a poet. It's pretty awesome. Okay.
I appreciate that. I think that's cool, you know, that I think some of the things that I write more, it's going to be interesting to work on these longer short stories that I am next year. Because we'll see if they have more of a narrative that usually drives more of a cinematic kind of thing. But one more diptych from the Diptychs and Triptychs book. Is that okay?
Yes, it is.
All right, cool. This is called Two Smiles. One, she smiles, takes a long drag off her cigarette. That shit's going to kill you, he says. She exhales away from him toward the waves. Not before you do, she says. They watch the water recede, the small sand crabs skittle sideways. Two. She smiles, takes a long drag. The smoke pours out of every orifice, even her ears. I think of Alice in Wonderland. Think, who might I be, the Mad Hatter? Today I've donned a beret. Our teacher is demonstrating how to make cowboy hats. I'm Rolodexing through the men I slept with last year, but I can't recall any of their unremarkable names.
And, you know, that's the kind of poem, too, where you got these fucking awesome visual things that, like, all of these crabs going skittling sideways across the water and the smoke pouring out of every freaking orifice. And this is Rolodex of forgettable people. You can't even remember their names. It's great.
Thank you. Well, you know, this one was published by Nicolette Wong over at A Minor.
A Minor.
And one of the things that she had said about the piece itself is she liked how it was two vignettes about a similar scenario, how it starts out. Because it starts out with the woman who smiles and takes a drag. But it spins off into two very different vignettes, you know, one that has one tone and the other one kind of goes into the other. And I think, you know, that's one of the things you can play with as a writer, too. One of the things that I suggest, first of all, sensory details, whether you're writing prose or fiction, you know, fiction or poems, they really help to build the scene, you know, to have different things like smell tossed in. You know, especially when you're in a scene, like let's say you're on the ice and the ice is like starting to crack and the skaters are out there. And you wouldn't normally think of smell because it's winter, right? But you're out there and you can build the fear in with the sounds and the this and that. But go to the sense that wouldn't normally be pursued in a scene and then think about what you can filter in there, you know? So that's a little thing there. So that book, it's a fun book. It's always weird with the second. I don't know, where are you in terms of, like, your siblings? Where do you fit into your family?
I'm the older brother. I have a younger brother.
Okay, so you're first.
I'm the first, yeah.
Okay, so, I always think of it like, okay, you're one of two. Okay, so I always think of books like kids. I think they're like your babies.
Sure.
You know, when you birth these things, you put them in there, you push them into the world. You know, so the second, I always feel like with the second, it's like, make room for me, come on. You know, like it's an elbowing way out, you know, and then they go like, come on, I'm here too, you know.
Yeah.
So I feel like I have to protect this one a little bit. Like I have to, you know, this is the thing that I always feel is so complicated is you walk this fine line currently in the world, the market that we're in with books and everybody's a writer. Where, how do you promote without being obnoxious, and how do you talk a project up without being, you know, like putting your foot in your own mouth? You know what I mean? Like, there's that thing, like, I just want it to sell. I want it to be a pretty book in a front window of a store and just have somebody walk by and go, I got to get that. You know, something like, I don't want it to be, you know, some of my friends I think are just overboard with the sell, you know, and it's like, you're a writer.
Yeah.
You don't have to sell, you know?
Yeah.
So.
You don't have to, it doesn't matter if the fucking thing doesn't sell, you know, either. That's the other thing, you know, give it a break. You know what I mean?
Right. I think so, for sure. And then the other, you know, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I'd love it if you'd read some more from your forthcoming book, The Attics and Basements. A&B.
Okay. Well, how many more pieces do you want me to read? Because I want to save one for the very last. So,
why don't you give me two more, man? Please.
Two more. Okay. Let's see. Let me find one. I'm going to find one that I wouldn't – okay, this is kind of one that I wouldn't normally read. Okay, this is called Man on the Moon, which, you know, I think that is the name of a Sting song or – it's some – oh, no, R.E.M. It's an R.E.M. song.
I do –
yeah, remember that song Man on the Moon that has to do with, like, the comedian that died?
Oh, yeah, Charlie Kaufman. Exactly,
about Andy Kaufman.
No,
okay, so
– Andy Kaufman.
So this has nothing to do with Andy Kaufman or R.E.M., Michael Stipe, nothing. But probably from listening to that song over and over, it might have informed some of the poems. So Man on the Moon. After Billy fell in the well, Una would sleep in fields of flax and hay, fields of gold. Overgrown, uncut, the dominion of grasshoppers and crickets. Una would whisper minutia to the yellowed, splintered fray, prayers to invoke Billy's return. But unlike each dawn, glinting through boughs, he would not show, could not come back. Sometimes she would scream his name, and meadowlarks would flock away, crows caw, caw, caw. The house, a permanent weathered shell, sat somber on the hillside. Una tried to think of men on the moon, looking back at our opalescent spinning sphere. She wanted to see the world in its entirety, massive as they had, at that distance. She wanted to sail her heart to join Billy's in the moon's shadows.
That's something else. In the Moon Shadows. That's great. Oh my god.
Yeah, that's a Van Morrison line.
Yeah.
So this whole poem really is like a, it's like a, I'm sleeping with all these different singers, you know, with all their lines.
Yeah,
I'm like dreading.
Yeah, I know. I heard the Fields of Gold, right? That's Sting himself right there, right? He's in there somewhere.
Yeah, that's a Sting thing. And I think, yeah, there's a few of them in here, which just kind of ties the piece together. But, yeah, and then the overall loss, trying to deal with loss. And I think music, you know, music is something that always reminds us of people that a lot of times that aren't here anymore. You know, there's a song you'll hear and you'll go, oh, you know, for me, I lost one of my best friends growing up at 27.
Uh-huh.
And he loved that song, Nights in White Satin, by the Moody Blues.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So when
no,
I can't
yeah.
even listen to that song without, you know, he's like in the room when I hear that song. You know, like I
oh,
hear it
yeah.
and I'm like, oh, I turn around to look for him.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's how music is. It has that, it's attached to memory, you know. So,
yeah.
So that's intense. Okay, one more, and then you got to get Sam on the show, and I'm going to listen. I listened to your whole show tonight. By the way, I have to tell you, Chuck is great, too. I've always admired his work. I go back a couple years, you know, just exchanging congratulations, and I loved your piece, blah, 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 you know, that kind of stuff with him, too. So that was so cool to hear you talk to Chuck.
I got to say, there's something about just Chuck's work. You know, he doesn't he just kind of comes out of nowhere. Just, you know, it's easy. It's awesome. You know, he's a great guy, man. I hope we get to mix some alcohol together next time you're in the city.
He's so cool, and I didn't realize that he was there. I thought for some reason he was up in Boston, so it's cool that
That fucker, man. He's usually within striking distance. We're usually getting drunk every other weekend at least. You know, it's a vicious cycle of awesomeness. You know, what are you gonna do?
I love it. Yeah, very cool. We'll have to party. All right. So this last piece I'm going to read is called The Femur.
Okay.
And it's the first piece in Attics and Basements. So,
right.
And I read it last night in Chicago too. So and this is for Meg, because this is one of her favorite pieces. So, The Femur. When my ex FedExed me a small box of her pubic hairs, it ranked right up there amongst the strangest things I'd ever received in the mail. But the oddest was my grandfather's femur. I was away at college when he passed, shoved in front of a train by his third wife while visiting Berlin, my mother's theory. Then Dad decided to send along the package. When I opened it, I wasn't quite certain if it was a joke. No note, no return address, just the bone, suspended and fused inside a rectangular plastic frame, like a tarantula my kid's sister had. I placed it on my dorm room closet shelf. Through the years and multiple moves later, I'd grown attached. It was as if we shared bone, cartilage, nerves, connective tissues. It was what prompted me to pursue forensics, and I'd towed it, not an easy task, to my yoga classes or to weekly seminars in Vegas. Cradle it at night, the smooth surface reassuring, hum ourselves to sleep. After I got married, my wife begged me to get rid of it, wouldn't listen when I pleaded with her to let it stay. She said it was too creepy. Really? What she doesn't know is that I snuck it under the mattress, above the box spring on my side of our bed, and I can feel it every time I lie down, growing.
Oh, that's something else, man. Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you big time for coming on and reading and for visiting everybody here tonight again. I really hope you'll come back again soon.
Bud, you're the best, man. I love being on your show.
I'm going to have to drag you back on pretty soon. I think I'm going to put together like a reading night on here where I'll try to get different people to come on and we'll do a big reading. We'll see what happens with that. Who knows? I'm full of bullshit ideas, you know what I mean?
No, I think that's a good idea. I think it's fun to have, like, a reading night, and you can just pick, you know, pick people that you really know want to read their work. I mean, I think Sam would actually be down with that because he's got that new kick-ass book out, too.
Speaking of which, Robert, I want to say goodnight to you, and I'm gonna pull Sam on.
Have a great time, bud. It was so good chatting with you, and thanks for letting me read my work.
Huge pleasure, man. Be good, all right? All right, next on the show, we've got Sam Snook Brown. Sam, are you there?
I'm here.
Jesus Christ, Sam.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, man. I saw you hanging out on the switchboards, and I'm glad that you hung in there.
That was great.
Tonight.
Great
how
to
you doing?
Robert.
Oh, Robert's the man, isn't he? He's the fucking man, dude.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, and a genius at Segways. Who knew?
Yeah, oh, man. I just ordered both of his books, actually, while I'm on the air here, the new one that's out. And actually, I just finished reading your book the other day, Box Cutters, from Sunny Outside Press. And I got to say, man, it was phenomenal book. I would say it's a chapbook. I would describe it as a chapbook of short prose to people who are listening, and I recommend you pick it up.
Thanks so much, man.
You want to kind of set up a little bit about your own thoughts of Box Cutters, people who are listening? What's the underlying themes, and what's the book about?
I put together this thing thinking about relationships. I feel like everything kind of comes back to that in one way or another. Everything is necessarily couple relationships, romantic relationships. There's that story in there about the title story about the prisoners setting up the corporate dividers in the office building. But it's all about human connections, I think, and how tenuous and both fragile but necessary those can be. I think that's kind of what it comes down to. That's what I had in mind anyway.
Yeah, I think the story that stood out the most for me in it, there's a guy, he's got a truck full of feed, and he's driving, he gets stuck in traffic, and he's trying to connect with a girl in a sports car, I believe, and he's trying to call her, he's trying to get her to call him on his cell phone by writing his number on a piece of paper. That was a perfect example of that, you know, just trying to connect with people and the distance of relationships and all that.
Lemuel. That's the guy's name in the story, Lemuel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that poor dude. I know a lot of people like that. I work with a lot of people like that, that's for sure. I mean, now, I've seen some news popping up. You got a novel coming out. And I was reading about it.
Uh-huh.
Is it based in the Civil War era? Is that the deal?
It's set right at the tail end of the Civil War. The end of the book actually occurs toward the end of 1865. So it's actually the last couple of years, and then about a year after the Civil War.
Cool. Are you yourself kind of a Civil War buff kind of person, or are you just kind of are intrigued by the era and just want to write about it?
I've been a Civil War nut since I was a kid. When I was 11, my grandparents took me on a trip all through the South visiting the battlefields by my own request. It wasn't even like their trip. It was because I wanted to go. So I've been a big nut for that for a long time. I've always kind of been fascinated by the rift, the divide in this country. And growing up in the South, it was a lot more real to me, too. So,
Where did you grow up?
I've always been kind of geeked out by that. I grew up in Texas.
Yeah, you grew up in Texas. When I think of Texas, this is like my East Coast, Yankee thinking. I had this weird thing where I don't really think of Texas as like the South.
It's a weird place.
I just think of Texas as Texas. You know.
Yeah.
I almost in like my brain, like when I think back to then, I think of like. Like Texas is still being like part of Mexico, you know. It's just like it's just like this weird place. I think when I'm thinking of the South, I'm thinking of like Georgia and you know.
Oh sure, yeah, the deep South, capital D, capital S, yeah.
So now you went
you went from Texas to check out all the battlefields and all this stuff when you were a kid. And what was the coolest thing you saw then?
I remember vividly, and I don't even remember what battlefield it was, to be honest, but I remember there was one battlefield that my grandparents and I went out on, and they still had a bunch of the old artillery set up. So there were cannons in lines on these little ridges. It just looked like lawn. The grass just looked like it was just lawns. But they had these little ridges in them, and the cannons were all lined up across them, and you could go check them out. And, you know, being a kid, I was like, cool, weapons, right? So I stuck my head, like, right inside the muzzle of the cannon. And they were all plugged up with concrete, and I was disappointed that there wasn't a cannonball inside. But when I turned around and I looked across the battlefield, I saw this entire line of opposing cannons aimed back the other direction, aimed at me. And that really spooked me. That, you know, I was only 11, but for some reason that really kind of sunk in the reality of what was going on those battlefields. And it really brought it to life for me, that the idea that you're basically facing down this barrage of cannon fire.
Yeah, I think I remember being a kid and just being, like, so into, like, you know, the idea of war, you know, how cool it was. And then, you know, seeing like some of the epic movies where they realistically depict it, and I'm like, holy fuck.
Yeah.
Wow, watching people get blown apart and stuff. So now, your book that you're writing in the Civil War, it starts with the tail end of the Civil War, the book that you have written.
Sure.
What's the, what does it focus at all on battle? What's it focusing on? What's the
only time that battles get brought up in terms of formal Civil War documented battles are in just references from characters and dialogue. The book itself is actually set down in the bayou of southwestern Louisiana, literally the middle of nowhere. Had absolutely nothing to do with the war whatsoever. It was, in fact, it was the place that people went to hide when they were trying to get out of the war and didn't want to get dragged back into it through conscription. So that's where I set the book. So there's not really battles in that sense, but there were a lot of skirmishes that took place on the rim of the bayou. And so the story that I've written concerns these, it's a pair of women, an old woman and her daughter-in-law living in the bayou. And anytime some of these skirmishes, these soldiers running away from the battle or chasing people from the battle out into the swamp, the women are basically waiting there for them, and they kill them and strip them of their clothes, their weapons, everything they can get off of them, and sell it back to the military on the black market. And that's the only way they know how to make a living during the war. So that's the whole book, basically, in terms of what action there is. It's not battles. It's these desperate women killing anybody that comes into their territory just to make a living.
Well, that sounds a lot more interesting to me than a big prose about battle. Anyway, that's awesome. I gotta say, I actually I wound up a couple of years ago. I went to one of these it's like a writer's workshop things or whatever, and there was this guy who was there, and he was talking about, like, you know, writing successful fiction, you know, and all this stuff. And he was just, like, talking about writing this story about a fucking tank division, you know. And, Jesus Christ, man, I fucking fell asleep in the middle of his talk. I was like, that is exactly the opposite of what I'm interested in, you know. The story of the conflict of people in conflict is, you know, it's much more interesting than somebody... Yeah, somebody who spilled a glass of water on a piece of paper is a little more interesting to me than that anyway. But so that's cool. What's the name of this book?
Hagridden.
I've seen it. What is it?
Hagridden. It's all
Hagridden.
One word.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What is Hagridden?
It's a term that refers to, originally it literally referred to guys who were like, obsessed with women. They were sort of haunted by their sexual desire. And it was a reference to, like, you know, wet dreams, basically.
the sort of succubus that would visit men, and they were just possessed by their obsession. But eventually it came to mean anybody who was sort of haunted or obsessed with anything that would sort of send them into nervous breakdowns. And so for me, I mean, there's a bit of a love interest bit to the book where there's a guy who deserts the war and comes back into the bayou where he used to live and starts trying to seduce the younger woman, which freaks the older woman out because the younger woman is her only means of survival and she doesn't want to lose her.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of conflict there, and they wind up kind of becoming sexually obsessed with each other, the girl and the guy who moves back into the neighborhood. But it's really about how the war kind of haunts them all, and the neuroses that they deal with because of, even though they're not in the war, they don't see it, they barely hear about it, but the destitution that they live in is a direct result of the war. So they're constantly aware of it.
Well, that's something else. So that's forthcoming. That's something that's in the pipe. And
I've seen fall.
Which is exciting. That's great. But you're on the heels of this great keyboard. It's like so strange to call it a chapbook because I don't often think of short prose and chaps together, you know. But that's what it is. It's a really beautiful chapbook. Sunny Outside Press. They always put out really fucking cool shit. And I was lucky enough. I've met David in person and got to talk to him and kind of to look at some of his products that he puts out and talk to him in depth last weekend about what really goes into editing and putting together a book. And I guess really my question is, did you get anything new out of the process of working with them on this box cutter thing? Do you think it kind of opened your eyes to new things, or just kind of it was more of an internal thing of fucking with the text and tearing it apart and stuff like that?
It's funny. I for some of these stories, I kept trying to push what I might call a softer ending onto them. Occasionally in kind of early in my writing, when I was doing a lot of grad school workshops and things like that, people kept telling me, oh, you're so bleak. Oh, this is so brutal and blunt of an ending. And, oh, can't you just be happy for once? And so I tried to soften up some of the endings on these. And that was probably the biggest editing bit that we did, David and Brian Meadock and me. When we were going over this thing, was to strip all that out and say, no, fuck it, let's just get hard with it, you know? Be mean. This is life. Deal with it. And so we cut some of the softer edges out, and it became a lot sharper in the stories, which, frankly, I'm happy with. It was kind of my instinct in the first place. So I was really glad to see them see that in the stories and give me permission to go back to those.
Yeah, it's funny when all of a sudden you're teamed up with an editor who kind of understands your instincts more as a, you know, it almost seems to me like a project could go in 50 different directions with 50 different people, you know, and kind of the final product you have is like just kind of the luck of the draw with how it worked out. And I really think this book was a success. And I'm kind of curious. Have you been doing any readings for it? And it's do you have anything coming up? What's going on with
Box Cutter? My whole life has kind of revolved around the academic calendar because I teach as well.
Sure.
And this fall semester has been extremely busy for me lately. So I've been kind of holding off. It just came out in November anyway. I was going to really start hitting the reading circuit come January, February. I'm going up to AWP at the end of February, doing some things up there in Seattle. So,
nice.
I'm going to start trying to carry it around and do some things. I did a couple of readings in the summer before it came out, which was cool. And then I did a thing this fall right after it came out. I did a thing at one of my college campuses where I teach. So yeah, yeah, I've done a couple of readings, but I haven't really hit the circuit yet. I'm kind of waiting until the winter to do that.
Now, where do you live now? I get the impression you're in Portland, Oregon?
I am in Portland, yeah. Portland,
Holy
Oregon.
Holy fuck, lucky guess. That's great. I know a few people at really cool pizza in Portland. A friend of mine, Martha Grover, is there, and she does this great, like, you know, the moth storytelling kind of thing. She does one of
that. Yeah, yeah.
Right outside of town. I'm not sure. It's like a little suburb of Portland. She does like a Tad's Chicken House or something. Do you ever hear that? Tad's
mm-hmm.
Chicken and Dumpling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a really great time. But that's really cool, man. I'm looking forward to seeing you read from this book at AWP because that'll be a blast. And I'm curious.
Oh yeah, that's right. You're gonna be there, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to go.
I'll buy you a whiskey.
There we go. I'll buy you a whiskey, too. How does that sound?
All right. Good. Two whiskeys. That makes me happy.
Yeah, two whiskeys coming up. Can I pry a story out of you? Are you in the mood?
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great. You want something from the collection, from Box Cutters?
I would love it if you read something from Box Cutters. Please choose whatever you're in the mood to read. I enjoyed the whole collection, so whatever you're in the mood to read, please.
Let's read poor Lemuel. Let's give him his due here. I have a soft spot for this guy because he turns up as a young kid in a novella that I've written. Hasn't seen the light of day yet, but I'm still cleaning it up. But anyway, this is adult Lemuel, poor guy. So this is Distance. This is from about the middle of the book, if anybody wants to go grab this somewhere. But that's the title of the story, Distance. It had been a month, nearly, since he'd impulsively bought the cell phone for the feed business, and Lemuel hadn't seen any use for it until that day in San Antonio when the semi tipped and stopped traffic flat. Some people had killed their engines, and Lemuel killed his, too. He left the windows up against the winter snap, but he took out a white-tipped swisher anyway, and he let the smoke rest up at the roof of the old Ford's steel cab. Sometimes he turned to check the feed in the bed of the truck, but mostly he just smoked and watched the people in traffic. A lot of them were on their cell phones, shouting, their faces stretched funny in the silent standstill. When he finished his smoke, he cracked his window and pitched out the plastic tip. Someone honked at him. His lips tasted of mint and of smoke. The person honked again. Lemuel turned and scanned out the back window over the feed sacks at the woman in the blue Jetta, who pointed at the street beside him and mouthed her own shouts. He nodded and tipped two fingers to the bill of his cap. She gave him a finger, just one, and blared the horn again. He looked around at the rest of the traffic, people on phones telling loved ones, bosses, friends about the semi up ahead, the things they weren't getting done, the things they wanted to do. Lemuel's phone lay on the seat next to him. No one. There was a woman in a faded old Corvette, the black gone cloudy in patches. Lemuel watched her. She sang along to some song, slapping the steering wheel like a man. Lemuel liked her. Her blonde hair streaked with ashy brown, shortish up front but thick and wild down her back. She had a tough look to her, like she could handle feed and pickups and men who dealt with those things. A woman, too, though, and sexy. She had the same look as the rubbed gray paint on her Corvette, not faded but broken in and easy to look at in the winter cool, smoothed over at the curves without losing her edge. This was all he could see, and Lemuel didn't really know what he thought about the woman, or about women in general, or even about love, but he felt he was getting to know this woman just sitting there in his truck, watching her, and he thought that with her he could figure out love. So Lemuel tried something. He flipped open the phone to check the number that called it, the one he'd never bothered to memorize, and he wrote the number on the back of the insurance card from his glove box. Then he honked his horn, the blaring of compressed air echoing in the Ford's big blocky hood, until she turned to look. He smiled, waved his phone at her, and slapped the number against his passenger window. She stared at it and at Lemuel's big grin, but she turned her head away. "Nah," Lemuel thought. "Nah, you don't know. I'm a gentle guy. I take care of you." He sounded the horn again, grinned bigger with his eyes wide and his eyebrows high, and he nodded at her and said out loud, "I'd love you good." And swearing by the good Lord Jesus, he meant it. She squinted at him, for the sun, he thought, which came down hard like a hand flat across the face in San Antonio, even in winter. Dear Lord, he hated coming to the city. And he looked at her head, and she shook her head. Lemuel laughed for her and said out loud, his voice drumming around in the empty pickup cab, "You just don't understand." He waved his phone again, pointed its little antenna at her, and then at himself, and then at his pen-scrawled number on the insurance card. He nodded across the asphalt, his heart reaching right out the plaid of his button-down and through their windows to show her how he felt. She rolled her eyes away and to her seat. Then she looked across and smiled back, a toothy mirror across the frozen highway, and she took up her own phone beside her, dialed, held it to her ear. Then Lemuel's phone rang, foreign but musical to him, opportunity calling ahead of the knock at the door. He smiled still bigger, his stubble-patched face split across the middle, and he looked for the button that answered the phone, found and pressed it, held the tiny thing awkward to his ear. "Fuck off," she said. He saw her close and toss away her phone, turn back to the dead traffic ahead. She put her splayed left hand up to her face like a screen, her elbow on the door. Lemuel sat with the phone still to his head, watching. He looked into the bed, the feed back there, cold in spite of the sun, the woman behind him still glaring at the swisher tip in the road. He looked ahead at the long line of traffic stretched around Loop 410. He turned back to the vet, phone to his ear the whole time.
I just love all the possibilities of this for all these characters, all these incidental characters. You know, what's looming ahead? You know, this it says a lot about this girl in the Corvette. To it's one thing to call, and then another thing to say fuck off when you're stuck in a line of traffic. You know, and this lady staring, who's so caught up. You know, and she's got nothing else to be preoccupied with. This small, tiny little bit of trash. You know.
Uh-huh.
This is great. This guy still has the phone to his ear, like he's whether does he not know what to do with it, or is he just like holding on to the tiniest possibility of hey, maybe she'll call back. I don't know. It's a great little picture.
Yeah,
it's like a short little film of a short story. Nice job, man.
Well, thank you, man.
I gotta thank you for coming on the show. I really hope I'll have to send you an email. We'll have to do this again real soon. I want to get you to come back on and read some more from your book.
And, that'd be great. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, please. Thank you for coming on today. And we're going to wrap the show up here. So I hope you have a really good night. And I hope to catch you at AWP.
Thanks a lot, man. Yeah, absolutely. We'll grab a drink.
Yeah, most definitely, man. All right, well,
the whole world's coming to an end, Mal.
That's it. That's for the show. I mean, what can I say? I want to thank all the guests. Chuck Howe came on, and read from "If I Had Wings, These Windmills Would Be Dead," Elf from Unknown Press. Mick Everett, who came on and read from self-published Kindling and talked about her experiences owning a bookstore and being homeless in a Walmart parking lot. Robert Vaughn, who came on and talked about his great chapbook, Microphones, and who read from Diptychs, Triptychs, Lipsticks, and Dipshits, and also Addicts and Basements. Robert's always a blast. And, of course, Sam Snow Brown, the author of Fox Tutter, who was kind enough to read from that recent chapbook out from Sunny Outside Press. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Just another Tuesday. Put it on the calendar. Mark a big X there. Appreciate you listening, and once again, as usual, I'm not sure what the fuck is happening. Next Tuesday is Christmas Eve. The following Tuesday is New Year's Eve. So most likely you'll find me in absolutely no state of sobriety to be performing any kind of, probably talking at all. I'll probably just be curling up a ball somewhere around this time of night. But I hope to see you in 2014. All kinds of great shit coming up. There's always people putting out books that I'm excited about reading, and I hope you are too. So, catch you then.